Hello, Peach of Pearls listeners. It's Monday, March 4th, and I know many of you are traveling to AAD this week, so we are dropping some extra episodes in the feed to keep you entertained while you travel. First up for our March 4th Monday re-release is not one, but two webinars about the advances in understanding and managing molluscum in children. These webinars originally aired in the spring of 2023, and if you'd like to view the video version of these presentations, please follow the link in the show notes. On Tuesday, March 5th, we will drop a new episode from the team that brought to you the Eczema Counts Project, followed by brand new programming on Thursday, March 7th that you don't want to miss, with the very first episode of Pedra Pup Club and the first episode of our new Hidradenitis Suppurativa podcast series. Make sure that you've subscribed to our Pedra Pearls podcast channel so you never miss an episode. Safe travels and happy listening! Hello and welcome to the Pedra Molluscum Miniseries, Advances in Understanding and Managing Molluscum in Children, sponsored by Novan. In episode one, you'll hear from Dr. Nanette Silverberg. Dr. Silverberg is clinical professor of dermatology and pediatrics at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She's chief of pediatric dermatology at Mount Sinai Health System and director of pediatric and adolescent dermatology. She recently completed her position as chair for Pedra's Skin of Color and Pigmentary Disorders Focus Study Group. Welcome, Dr. Silverberg.
Thank you for having me. So molluscum is a topic dear to my heart. I started doing research in molluscum as a fellow in pediatric dermatology. And I think that there's a lot of excitement around molluscum now as we start to enter the era where we have FDA-approved medications. This talk is called Molluscum the Lowdown. These are my disclosures, and these are not related to molluscum topic, except for Verica. Molluscum is the scourge of fill in your own town. Every place I've practiced, people have been affected by molluscum. And I think that that is the major idea, that molluscum is fairly universal now for children in all locations, in all socioeconomic groups, races, ethnicities. It is something that is easily transmitted from child to child, and every child is at risk. Molluscum contagiosum virus is a pox virus. It's in that family of pox viruses with smallpox. So it is a double-stranded brick-shaped DNA pox virus. However, unlike smallpox, it can only go skin deep. So it can't invade deeper into the body. It will not go below the skin. There is a bimodal peak of onset starting in toddler years or preschool years, around 3 to 4 years of age. And we'll see why I give that range later. There's another peak that occurs. It's a little smaller around school age children. Those are usually kids who are starting to swim and get exposed in pools. And then after that, there's a steady state of molluscum occurring through childhood into adolescence and then early adulthood. As we go past the age of 15, we start to see a shift from MCV1, molluscum contagiosum virus type 1, to type 2, which is the sexually transmitted type. Molluscum is contagious when wet. 64% of kids swam before onset in a survey. Two-thirds of kids report co-bathing. It's bathing with a sibling or a friend. And many report daycare attendance and shared potties. And this is often why we see molluscum in the lower extremity in small kids. Another source of transfer for molluscum is fomites on shared towels or bath equipment. So we always say, everybody get their own towel, their own bath equipment, and don't share. Locations are pretty common for toddlers on the legs and popliteal region. Again, it's that potty distribution or sitting on the side of a small pool. School-age children tend to get molluscum on the axilla and trunk from pulling themselves up on the side of a pool, although they will get in other parts of the body as well, including the legs. We can see certain kids will develop atopic dermatitis or eczema as a result of molluscum. And that will often occur in areas that are already prone to atopic dermatitis, such as the popliteal region or the antecubital region. Molluscum can also occur on the mucosa, such as the conjunctiva, which can cause conjunctivitis, and it can occur in the oral mucosal surface. Molluscum are often described by their morphology as pearly papules with a central dell. The dell is really not visible in small children because it's so we say it's milia-like. It's very small. You really have to magnify it quite extensively to see the dell on something that's under a millimeter. We can see it on certain locations, so that can be on the eyelids. It's not just pediatric, but you know, it is sometimes the morphology is a little different there. We can see umbilicated nodular lesions. Those can mimic cysts or tumors. Big or giant molluscum are often seen on bottom of the feet. We'll see them also in smaller kids in the diaper region and in the intergluteal port area. And they can mimic condyloma in that location. They can be conglomerated so that they look like one big plaque, mimicking a herpetic appearance. They can be erythematous and look like a spitznevus. They can be inflamed and look like an abscess or be an abscess. And they can also be pedunculated. Molluscum is a great mimicker in pediatric dermatology, and it will look like other conditions. So we've mentioned some of them. Of course, we're seeing dermatitis in about a quarter of kids, but up to half of kids will develop atopic dermatitis when they are exposed to molluscum. We can see id reactions, that's that inflammatory papular reaction on the extremities that occurs when kids start to develop an immune response. You can see erythema multiforme-like at molluscum, which is molluscum in the center, the halo around it, and then the real redness at the edge. So those three zones, but the central zone is the molluscum. Again, we talked about how it looks like acne, milia, cysts, but it can mimic infections. And we've had kids here admitted to the hospital thinking that they had infections like Lyme disease or herpes or abscesses or condyloma. And it behooves us to take a look with a magnifier and look for these molluscum and to help people come to this diagnosis. It can also look like viral exanthem. So when molluscum lines up in an axilla and then the dermatitis around the area starts spreading, it can mimic unilateral lateral thoracic exanthem. And Giannotti crusty-like lesions have been reported, and that can also look like the id reaction as well. We have seen in our own meeting some discussion of molluscum being parts of immunodeficiency syndromes, both iatrogenic and congenital, like the X-Men syndrome, and we have to think of that as well when we see extensive molluscum. So again, we talked about milia lesions on the head and neck in young kids. Can mimic acne or perioral dermatitis. What is most impressive about molluscum in younger kids is that it's contagious to parents and siblings. And while I've only had probably a dozen parents who've caught from kids through the past decades, kids catch from each other all the time. We say up to 45% of kids will have reported having caught from a sibling. The lower chin and neck can be a parent place a parent will catch from hugging. You can see this little child over here nuzzling in with their parent and unfortunately giving them a little molluscum. And then giant or intertriginous, we've discussed already. The boat sign is the beginning of the end. And when we start to see a really strong dermatitis around the molluscum lesions, we may start to see some fading of the molluscum or reduction in their size as that occurs. And that is the beginning of the end. Sometimes that looks miserably itchy or is miserably itchy. And it is important for us to treat those kids symptomatically to be more comfortable. The boat sign has to be distinguished from impetigo. So two centers in Jerusalem, Israel, looked at their cases of boat sign versus impetigo. They had 56 kids who were suspected as having infections because of the swelling in the area. Mean age at presentation was 4.6 years. Fever was reported in 12.5%, and actually 62.5% received antibiotics. When they cultured them, 55% had sterile cultures or commensals, and 7 had positive cultures. So that's some of them didn't receive cultures at all. So no statistical difference was observed between the patients with pathogenic isolates and patients with sterile or non-pathogenic cultures in terms of demographics. It is really sometimes hard to distinguish, and we do have to keep a fair amount of concern for potentially for a secondary superinfection in our kids. Here's a demonstration of erythema multiforme like dermatitis. Again, our little central molluscum, and then zone of clearance and zone of erythema. Again, here's our Giannotti crusty like molluscum dermatitis over the extensor extremities. So molluscum has a reason that lingers. So we usually say when we think about molluscum that about 20% will be gone at a 6-month time period, about 50% at a year, about 70% at a year and a half, and we approach 90% by 2 years. But we do have some kids who linger beyond the 2-year mark. And a part of the reason we see that is molluscum has virulence factors that helps the virus evade immune response. Those are protein products that are produced, and there are more than 20 of them, but we'll just mention a few that have recently been discussed, including the MC005 and MC132, which inhibit NF-kappa beta. The reason that's really important to me is that in looking at old studies of tacrolimus, there was a hint in those studies that there may be a worsening of molluscum spread or of lesions with tacrolimus topically. And that is something that affects the NF-kappa beta cycle. So it could be that the molluscum was interacting with that or preventing the tacrolimus from working, and the tacrolimus was preventing the molluscum from clearing, one of those. So MC159, MC160, and MC163 reduces apoptosis so that these molluscum are trying to live as hard as possible. And finally, MC53 and MC54 neutralize interleukin-18, and that prevents interferon gamma production, which is essential for viral destruction. There is a lot of symptomatology with molluscum, and everybody says, oh, you know, not a big deal, it'll go away. Well, you know, 2 years of misery is not necessarily a good thing for kids. So pruritus is very has been reported in 14%. Inflammation, same numbers. Dermatitis can be upwards of 60% depending on the studies. Impetigo and superinfection, again, up to 29% in some studies. Conjunctivitis and pain. There really are kids who have pain. I have seen kids admitted into the hospital for suspected abscesses when the molluscum get giant. And they can be a lot of downside to untreated molluscum infections. Here's our peak age of molluscum so around the world. So we're looking at months, basically. And when we look at age and months, it seems like the average is about 4.5 years. And one of the reasons we see some variation in the studies is that some studies report kids based on the first onset of their lesions, so, such as mine. It's the one at the end, just before the average, New York, Silverberg. So here we go, a little more than 4 years in terms of the age of onset versus these studies like this one, which looked at the kids on the day they arrive in your office. And often that's going to be 12 to 24 months later. So just something to consider. Peak age of molluscum seems to overlap quite a lot with atopy. And that may be why molluscum has been become more common in our practices. But on the other hand, molluscum can trigger atopic dermatitis. So the appearance of molluscum in younger kids may be the cause of some of our increase in atopic dermatitis in the general population. And we're seeing that across the board. So again, peak age and months of molluscum and atopy can be quite similar depending on the location. If we add in some exposures, such as family members and outside contacts, we have a good reason why molluscum is occurring at certain time periods. But essentially, a lot of times what we're seeing is that the school-age child is giving it to the preschooler or vice versa. And that may account for why there are multiple peaks. What we do see also here is this data reported in Native Americans, and similar data has been discussed for Aboriginal patients in Australia. And conceptually, there may be some concern for molluscum occurring earlier and being associated with more untreated dermatitis in populations that have poor access to care and low income. Again, more conditions to think about, impetigo, bacterial infections, and here's scabies. Again, a marker of a poor population that has poor resources. So things we think about in our practices on a daily basis. Molluscum is common in younger kids. So it's more common today, but when we look at first graders versus sixth graders, right, we can see you know, there's a little peak here if still in first grade, but drops off by sixth grade in Japan. And then same thing for Native Americans, common in less than one and 1 to 4 years. Molluscum is really itchy. It can trigger new onset atopic dermatitis. It can trigger sustained atopic dermatitis flaring or increased severity. And AD patients have more molluscum lesions and more dermatitis. MCV can trigger AD, molluscum, dermatitis, but also id reactions. So again, here's some more data in different locations, thinking about studies that have reported atopy in their patient population. And you can see here ranges any place from the mid-30s up until 60%. Congenital transmission has been reported in molluscum. So 30% of kids less than 6 months have molluscum antibodies, and that protects them if mom has molluscum. But we have seen reporting of molluscum on the scalp. And this is a case series that I did years ago with the late, great Arnold Duranji, looking at our cases of congenital molluscum and all of them occurring really on the scalp. In areas that would be perceived to be in contact with either the cervix or coming through the birth canal. Other forms of horizontal transmission also are sexual transmission, so common infection in teenagers, the groin area, including genitalia, buttocks, lower abdomen, and inner thighs. We should look for co-infections with other STDs. This is really super common now in younger patients, 15 to 24. The natural history, again, of molluscum is about half are gone at 12 months and 70% at 18 months. So there is something good on the horizon, but we do have to counsel our patients. And what's interesting is, again, when we look at older studies, sometimes they underreport the time it took to clear. Because they looked at when the patient came into the office and how long it took to clear after treatment. And the reality is that if you really look at your patients and you address the time that the disease started until the end, it's really about 2 years to get everybody clear versus the data that looks at patients who are coming into our offices, many of whom are waiting many months to see a pediatric dermatologist. Molluscum can cause poor quality of life. It can be cosmetically disfiguring. It certainly causes parental anxiety. And 82% of parents reported that molluscum contagiosum concerned them moderately or greatly. There is a stress of many therapeutic sessions. You know, ultimately, many parents are of a belief that we'll clear the lesions instantly. And the fact is that we need to wait for the body to meet us halfway. So we do the destruction of the lesions, but the body has to form immune response. And even when we do immunotherapy type treatments, we still have to wait months until the body's immune response is fully harnessed. Some of the other issues with kids are exclusions from sports and pool activities, which is a quality of life indicator. And self-consciousness and embarrassment. And of course, wearing long shorts and long sleeve swim shirts sometimes helps kids hide these lesions and also make them less contagious. Therapy for molluscum, and I know that's reviewed in the next section, but we really have to think about our therapies by dividing them up. Some really common therapies we use in the office are curettage, which requires topical lidocaine-based products or lidocaine-prilocaine combo, which of course can be associated with pain. Certainly, a lot of bleeding in the office when you scrape molluscum, and there is a potential for scarring. And we do have to be careful not to go very deeply, considering that molluscum are often very soft and do come off more easily. Cryotherapy, and of course, I am going to go back a second to this curettage because ultimately, it's not a great idea for eyelids or locations where a child might move. It's quite dangerous if you think that a child might move and have damage to a vital organ. Cryotherapy is widely available. It causes pain, and there is a potential for discoloration, particularly in darker skinned kids. And then we have topical retinoids, which have been described as low efficacy but easy access. They do cause irritation, which is kind of intended to force them to shrivel up and fall off. But that irritation can be disabling in an atopic. And finally, there have been discussions of Miquimod for molluscum. And in clinical trial, the agent had concerning side effects, but the trial was designed to have usage of 3 packets, up to 3 packets per day. And there have been other trials looking at extremely limited usage, 1 packet 2 or 3 times a week. And there was some partial reduction in lesions, but again, concerning side effects with the original clinical trial, which unfortunately the company never published, and it's rather hard to find it online. Again, majority of kids are young, they want painless therapies, and painless options are needed. And I thank you all for listening.
Thank you so much to Dr. Nanette Silverberg for this enlightening presentation. Please stay tuned for the second episode of this Molluscum mini-series with Dr. Adelaide Hebert, available right now. I would also like to extend our gratitude to Novan for sponsoring this program.
Hello and welcome to the second episode of the Novan-sponsored Molluscum mini-series, Advances in Understanding and Managing Molluscum in Children. Now, in episode 2, you'll hear from Dr. Adelaide Hebert about molluscum therapy. Dr. Hebert is a fellow of the American Academy of Dermatology and professor of dermatology and pediatrics at UT Health McGovern School of Medicine. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Hebert.
And I'll go ahead. I'm going to just discuss molluscum therapy. I have done research with all the grant funds paid to the medical school. I want to disclose that. And I've also listed my disclosures where I did receive the honorarium. So let's talk about the history of molluscum. This was first described back in 1817. So this was Bateman who was responsible for that publication. Then Patterson, which we all know from our derm path, demonstrated the infectious nature in 1841. And somebody named Julius Berg proved the viral nature in 1905. So we've talked about molluscum and its commonality. Dr. Silverberg has put this together for us very effectively. We know it's about 1% of all skin disorders that are diagnosed. It does occur throughout the world. Dr. Silverberg has alluded to the fact that it's more prevalent in tropical areas. And then we can see it in kids in all ages, even after birth, but it is more rare if they're less than 1 year of age. And she alluded to the commonality of the skin condition in if they are, in children with close contact. We talked about swimming pools, so I'll let that construct stay. There's about 1 million cases diagnosed a year, so this is a common problem. I mean, we all see it in pediatric dermatology. We know that about only 15% come in for medical care. We don't know if they just treat it at home or they don't have resources to go to medical care, but we know that the result of not getting care is that these lesions continue to spread, and we certainly see molluscum almost daily in our clinic. We know that it's a common problem. And Dr. Silverberg alluded to the most common age groups being the 2 to 5 year old group. She talked about the auto inoculation, the fomites, the co-bathing, the direct contact childbirth. We also know about the atopic dermatitis, the lack of treatment, and the sibling-to-sibling transmission. And we know that 42% of all patients spread the virus to a sibling. So we have to be aware of these factors when we talk about treatment. So we know that the most common place that patients may start is they stop by their pediatrician's office. And it's interesting, in a survey that was done, the most common prescription given by pediatricians is actually mupirocin. Dr. Silverburn outlined for us that not all these patients actually have a bacterial infection, and probably many of them don't need mupirocin, but the inflammation, particularly the botsan, can be interpreted as the lesion being infected, and thus mupirocin is given. I do want to remind you that mupirocin has not been studied in clinical trials to treat molluscum, and I personally doubt it will have great efficacy. But do be aware that, as Dr. Silverberg alluded, these can become secondarily infected. We know about the impact of these lesions on children. I think sometimes it actually is more stressful for the parents. And again, these children often do not get invited to the sleepovers, swimming parties, or other events that they probably very much enjoy. So as Dr. Silverberg has covered a lot of this, I'm just gonna leave this touched on very briefly. We know that the incubation period can be from 2 weeks to 6 months. We often ask the kids, did you go swimming in the summer? I work in Houston, it's very hot here. Swimming is a very common thing that children will do, and many of them have gone swimming. So we often try to think about that as possible way that they might have caught it from a sibling or maybe a cousin, somebody spending the night, all those things. And molluscum, as Dr. Silverberg alluded to, can last up to 4 years if it's never treated. So keep that in mind. We talked also about the kids with eczema having, of course, a defective barrier, which renders them much more likely to develop the molluscum lesions and wart lesions and other viruses as well. So keep that in mind. The comorbidity of molluscum in eczema patients is up to 80%. So again, broken barrier, perfect segue of that molluscum virus into the skin of a patient with atopic dermatitis. And if you think about evolution, why do patients have their molluscum lesions make their own dermatitis? Well, think about the best way to get into the skin is to break the skin barrier. So in evolution, those molluscum that were smart enough to invoke an eczema response, they were the ones that spread, they were the ones that proliferated. So it makes a lot of sense if you think about it simply as an evolutionary phenomenon. And that's what I tell my parents. Again, Dr. Silverberg has talked about the different types of molluscum. We haven't really studied this a great deal in terms of targeted therapy, but it is interesting that the common form is MC1 and the kind seen in patients with HIV is MCV2. We also see different forms in Australia and Asia, so be aware of that. And then epidemics can really occur, and you can have a lot of patients with molluscum in a very short time. We know that we can see widespread lesions, we can see persistent lesions, and we can see particularly resistant treatment to treatment lesions in those that are HIV positive who have low CD4 counts. And yes, we do see people with those low counts, even in this age, with very vibrant, available therapies for HIV infection. Dr. Silverberg alluded to the birth canal transmitting this vertically. So keep in mind those lesions and a circular pattern on the scalp may indeed be molluscum. We have a number of reviews in the literature. I want to make you aware of these because these are so comprehensive and helpful. There was a review on perspectives, etiology, diagnosis, and treatment from 2019. There was also a recent article for therapeutic approaches and special considerations in drugs and dermatology in 2021. We also have a consensus, which this was really a great article. That's the most recent article, appeared in February of this year, looking at the evasion of immune surveillance. And Dr. Silverberg touched on this. And it's such an important construct because why are these lesions so doggone hard to manage? And really, as we know, the ability to evade immune discovery, we really do have a challenge on our hands to make these lesions more readily available to the immune surveillance system such that the body can take care of these. So the risk of transmission is high. We talked about scratching making it worse. We know bathing makes it more spreadable, as does sleeping together. Here we have our beautiful histopathology of a molluscum lesion, and every derm resident as early as the first year can recognize the Henderson-Patterson bodies, which are so characteristic of this condition. The CDC on its website actually talks about recommendations regarding swimming pools. It does say kids can go swimming. We think it may be transmitted at the swimming pool, but I don't think it's a good reason to necessarily keep these children out of their swimming lessons or their background pool or their neighborhood pool, because they're probably going to get it from somebody else. And again, in Houston, it's very hot. So we need these kids to be able to swim, and we need kids to learn to swim, because drowning is still such a major cause of death during childhood. We don't want that to happen. Dr. Silverberg has alluded to transmission. She's talked about equipment. She's talked about pools. She's talked about fomites. So I'm going to let that rest. We don't have a perfect treatment at this time available to us. We know that surrounding areas are typically infected, and it's subclinical, because when the patient comes back and they think we've missed a few, it's actually new lesions emerging from those areas. We also know that recurrences are very common, especially if we haven't treated perhaps the causative case that brought it into the household in the first place. Some of the treatment areas are large. Certainly, if I'm using cantharidin, I only treat about 10 to 15 lesions, and I try to not do it in the thinner skin or in areas where the child might bend the knee or bend the arm, because those areas will tend to get more tender. I also try, if I can, to not treat the face, just because the blisters that result can be unpleasant and unsightly. So we certainly don't want the treatment to be worse than the disease. We do know that cantharidin, as Dr. Silverberg alluded, is still a common treatment modality for all of us in pediatric dermatology. We do see blistering. I tell the patients that, and the parents, that that's exactly what they're there in clinic for me to induce, because the blister is what helps the immune system recognize the virus. We know that there can be some sequelae in terms of using cantharidin, some discomfort, some pain. They can have discoloration, particularly in skin of color patients. And this is because of the vesicle mode of action. But we don't have a lot of really high-powered clinical studies on the use of cantharidin previously. I'll update you on some of that in the future. Currently, we don't have a single FDA-approved product for molluscum. We know that that's hopefully going to change in the next few years. Back in 1962, the only way that we could get the cantharidin, the way we get it in our clinic, is by getting a compounding pharmacy to prepare it for us. We're not in a hospital-based clinic, so we can use this. We don't really have a straight algorithm for using cantharidin. We use a dry end of a Q-tip, and we found that's very effective. We will touch on VP-102 solution, which is a standardized 0.7% cantharidin, in slides that follow. I love to quote Dr. Silverberg, because she has a great article in Cutis talking about the medical reasons to treat molluscum, and I think these are many. I think between the child getting bullied, the child's concern, the parent's concern, the discomfort spread, all these reasons are certainly warranted. Here's an article that I cited just a while ago. I do want to remind you that we have these available in the literature. And Dr. Silverberg provided this wonderful overview of possible therapies. And of course, we know when we have many therapies, we don't really have a cure. And I think this exposes us to the real challenge in managing these molluscum lesions very effectively. Dr. Silverberg also alluded to some of the treatments, including curettage. I tend not to do that in my clinic unless it's specifically asked for, because it's always unsettling. We have parents and sometimes children who faint if they see their own blood, and we like to avoid that. And we find it's probably not well tolerated, even with a good numbing cream put on before. And it also takes a lot of time, and we have to hold the child down. So it takes a lot of effort and resources to conduct this in small children. We've talked a little bit about some of the topicals. I'll allude to some that haven't been touched on. KOH has been used in some studies. I haven't found that it works that well for me, and so I avoid it. Salicylic acid can be effective. The others have all been mentioned, but we are going to talk about bendazimer sodium in some slides that follow. So what are the two pending medications to treat molluscum? We have VP-102, which I touched on. It's a product by Verica, berdazimer gel, 10.3% by Novan, and I'll discuss these in some detail. Let's first talk about nitric oxide. I do want to remind you that nitric oxide won the Nobel Prize, but for cardiovascular studies, and those that Nobel Prize was actually won by Farid Murad, who is at our institution quite a number of years ago, but the work he actually did was done in Virginia. But we're not going to talk about the cardiovascular aspects today, but talk about how this could impact favorably the treatment of molluscum. Why does this agent work? It is an antimicrobial and it has immunomodulatory properties. So I'll talk a little bit about the mechanism of action and talk about some of the safety data from the clinical trials. We know that nitric oxide was recognized by science as a breakthrough of the year in 1992. I talked about Dr. Murad's Nobel Prize in Medicine for Cardiovascular Disease in 1998. There have been lots of peer-reviewed manuscripts that deal with this. Again, it's antibacterial, it's antifungal, and it's antiviral. We know that it reduces key inflammatory mediators, including cytokines and chemokines. It does inhibit T-cell proliferation, and it modulates the apoptosis of key immune cells. So it's part of the natural immune response against microbial pathogens, and thus it really serves also as a key regulator of inflammation. So we know that nitric oxide works on the blood vessels and vascular tone. We're going to focus on the immune modulation because it really does have the potential to favorably affect many of the things we imagine in atopic dermatitis. We know that nitric oxide is not necessarily considered a stable molecule. So the challenge was to develop a product where we could have the proper release and the safe release of nitric oxide such that patients could benefit from it and it would stay within the correct webbing, if you will, of the property I'm going to discuss next. And we know that this is a new chemical entity. It was developed with a time-released capability in the vehicle. This would allow us to really use this product in a very safe and effective manner. It also has a good pH-controlled hydrolysis that allows the release of the nitric oxide. And it's a very nice balanced product that with good aesthetics. So we'll touch on that. Again, it is a nitrosyl platform. That's part of the solution that it's mixed in. So I want to make you aware of that. Over 4,000 patients have been treated with this particular product in clinical trials. And because we know 6 million Americans suffer from molluscum each year, it certainly is apropos to try to get a product that would allow us to give safe and effective treatment within the clinic. And that's what I'm going to discuss. Now, we know that the duration of the lesions can be long, and we know that auto incubation can play a key role. So ideally, we do want to find a favorable way to manage these in the clinic, and particularly those of you who practice in hospitals where you can't use non-FDA approved products. This really will allow potentially a platform for successful management. We know that the molluscum lesions actually replicate within the cytoplasm of the cell. As Dr. Silverberg mentioned, the replication is really limited to the human epidermis. The virus does enhance cell mitosis and it disrupts the epidermal cell differentiation. So again, in evolution, those molluscum lesions that provoked dermatitis could replicate and survive, and they're the ones that we're confronting today. We know that there is this immunoevasion because it can produce proteins that actually inhibit the host response to this infection, and that's key to recognize. And these viral proteins, as Dr. Silverberg alluded to, are MC160, 159, and MC54. And these actually prevent immune surveillance as well as apoptosis. So we'll look at these in a little bit different light and see that the nuclear factor of kappa beta is inhibited by these proteins. This is really a key component that we need to understand going forward, because these are the arenas in which immune surveillance as well as apoptosis are diminished. So we can see that we have no effective products in the pipeline for a very long time. So it is time for us to get some brand new arenas with FDA approval on the market so that we can manage patients with molluscum. Let's talk a little bit about berdazimer sodium. Again, here is the structure. You can see how the proton donor capability of this particular structure allows this macromolecule and this pyrosilaxone backbone to covalently bind this nitric oxide, and then it is released from the macromolecule. So in the clinical trials, and what you can expect is there will be a little plastic sheet. You'll put the berdazimer gel on this little strip as indicated. You add the hydrogel, you'll mix it up, and you'll apply this to the patient's skin. This is not complex. Our patients and parents were able to take this home with them. It was very easy to educate the parent regarding and have them use. What did we find from one of the in vitro studies? We found that there was inhibition of HPV-18 viral replication after 6 days, after just a 1 hour topical treatment with this gel, which was very exciting. And there was also successful rabbit model studies, which showed that there was reduction of both wild type and E8 mutation papilloma growth. So very, very good. So what does berdazimer gel do? Well, of course, we have this modulation of MF-kappa-beta, which is really nice, and the activation in turn of the immune surveillance as well as apoptosis. So this is very, very nice. And we know if we modify with this S-nitrosylation, as I've illustrated for you here, we again bring back immune surveillance and we bring back apoptosis. And that's exactly what we need to do, because these inhibitory proteins that are on the left side of the slide actually prevented those actions from moving forward. So again, what is S-nitrosylation? Well, here we see that the nitric oxide actually binds to a sulfur group on a protein, and then this action can modify various proteins, both in cell signaling, in the conformational change of key proteins, in cell death, cell survival, as well as viral inhibition. We'll touch on our publication related to the B-Simple4 clinical trial. It was an add-on trial because we didn't have all of our first two pivotal trials reach complete success in reaching the primary endpoint. So this study was added. It was a very large study. And here we had a very good outcome. Male and female patients were enrolled. They had to have 3 to 70 lesions at baseline. And we did study both primary endpoints as well as safety measures through week 24. We had a large enrollment, both on the vehicle gel as well as on the active portion of the study. And what we saw in this particular trial was we had a large portion of the patients complete, 377 in the berdazimer group and 377 in the vehicle group. This is amazing to have that many patients stay in the study. Pretty even distribution of male and female. We did have mostly Caucasian patients, as occurs in so many of the clinical trials we participate in. We did look at the BOTS sign in this particular trial, which is what we didn't do in the first two trials, but I do want to make you aware of that. So again, this was published in JAMA Dermatology, a very great paper. Looking at efficacy, you could see that there was a superior response in the orange bar graphs for berdazimer gel at week 12, but notice that there was statistical significance noted as early as week 2. We also saw at some of our secondary endpoints, there was better clearance if the patients were randomized to berdazimer as compared to the randomization to the vehicle gel. And over 90% clearance, again, outperformance in terms of berdazimer compared to the vehicle gel with statistical significance. We did also see a greater drop in lesion count if they were randomized to berdazimer gel, as illustrated in this particular slide. So again, looking at the publication JAMA Dermatology, we just want you to be aware of this. Adverse events and of transient nature were actually very mild for the most part. Some were just a little bit of irritation, application site pain, and some dermatitis did develop in the berdazimer group. There was some erythema, some pruritus, some exfoliation and dermatitis seen, and there was application site scar. That included those little dells that occur post-molluscum. Be aware of that. It wasn't necessarily a true and persistent scar. So looking at the erythema by weeks, it did diminish over time, and that was good. The same is true of some of the side effects. So going forward, these were some of the patients in the first two pivotal trials that participated in my study site. This, although it may look red and itchy, it was actually very well tolerated. We certainly didn't see parents want to discontinue. They were very happy with the results, and they felt that indeed the drug worked because they saw the evidence based on this response. So be aware of that. There were some localized skin reactions, which can occur with any topical. We don't mean to trivialize that, but we want to make you aware. These are some of my patients from the clinical trial. Again, this usually did indicate that the patient was going to be a good responder. It was not considered an adverse event in all aspects because it did pretty much predict who was on the real product and who was going to get better. So again, large cohort of patients enrolled in this particular clinical trial. The primary efficacy and safety landmarks occurred at 12 weeks. And while we don't know the exact mechanism of molluscum treatment with berdazimer, we know that these patients did well and did stay in the study and were successfully treated. And this is just a follow-up. So you can see, again, very nice outcome, a little bit of decreased pigment, but that goes away. It's just a little bit of post-inflammatory change. So again, the B-Simple trial was very, very effective. I'll touch on briefly in the minutes that remain VP-106. This is cantharidin. This comes in a small crayon-like plastic applicator. You can put it on in the clinic. It does have cantharidin as the active ingredient. It does have this little purple color, so you can see where you've already applied it. And they do have a bittering agent, so the child will not tend to want to put the lesions on the hands into the mouth. And again, you can see where you've applied it. This was also a multi-center trial. I did not participate in this particular trial, but they wanted to see how many patients got to clearance by day 84. They had to have a certain number of lesions in order to be eligible. Many of the patients did have previous treatments for atopic dermatitis. And as you know, many of the patients had atopic dermatitis. We did see complete clearance in more patients enrolled to the VP-102 than the patients enrolled on the vehicle of this particular drug. Now, we also saw quite a bit of change over time in terms of molluscum count. And I wanted to illustrate that, again, the VP-106 outperformed the vehicle virtually in all recorded study data at these various dates in this clinical trial. We did have some application site vesicles. That's not surprising because this is cantharidin. There was some pain, pruritus, erythema, discoloration, dryness, edema, and erosion. But again, we're not surprised if we're using a cantharidin-based product. We did see some vesicles. I want to mention that. Low discontinuation rate, even if they were on the VP-102 portion of this clinical trial. We did see good clearance of the lesions in the course of this trial, which was 84 days. Again, VP-106 outperforming the vehicle and better 90% clearance if they were on the true product as opposed to the vehicle alone. We know that we can have autoinfection, we can have reinfection. We've talked about these, so I'm going to go on. Most patients have 10 to 30 lesions. I'll just mention that. We've talked about the impact on the social aspects of the child's life. I believe there is good reason to treat molluscum. I know when parents come with their children to my clinic, they do want treatment. They don't want to be told, let's just watch it. They've already heard that from their primary care physician, and they are here for treatment. So try to limit spread as best you can. Try not to get the patients bathing together. I think they can go swimming. I think it's hard to prevent the kids from taking those lessons. So we do encourage those things. We do believe some lesions can scar. Dr. Silverberg touched on that. There's a lot of parental psychological stress, the discoloration of the skin. And of course, we don't want these lesions to get secondarily infection. I think that I'll go ahead and stop here. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you so much for tuning in to episode 2 of the Molluscum mini-series, Advances in Understanding and Managing Molluscum in Children. Thank you so much to Novan for sponsoring this program and to Dr. Hebert for her amazing presentation.